This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
The UK is getting hotter and wetter. Extreme weather events are happening more often. And that trend won't stop anytime soon. It all means more flooding and fire risk. Enter the R word, resilience. How well are we coping with what's going on now? And how advanced is our planning for what's coming? In the first of our three-part mini-series, looking at how resilient the UK might be in dealing with potential future crises, we're focusing on climate resilience. Follow me now into the briefing room. First, heat. Joining me in the air-conditioned briefing room is Mark Maslin, Professor of Climatology at University College London. Mark Maslin, how much warmer has the UK got in recent decades?
The UK has got significantly warmer. If we have a look at the last 50 years, the UK has warmed up by about 1.24 degrees Celsius. And that's quite a large amount. But it hasn't been uniform. So we've had about a quarter of a degree warming per decade. But in the last decade, it's about 0.4 degrees. So it has got much warmer. What's interesting is the last 3 years have been some of the warmest years on record. They're in the top five warmest years that the UK have actually had. But what's interesting as well is that the hottest days of summer have got even hotter.
So it's not an even spread over the year?
No, not at all. So we're getting hot, dry summers, warmer, wetter winters, but those extreme hot days in summer are becoming more common and warmer. And let's think about it. We've had four heat waves in the last 2 months in the UK.
And that is not an experience which somebody like me, who's on the wrong side of 60, grew up with.
No, none of us have.
Can we just look at how localised or otherwise this heating is? I mean, does it apply equally to all parts of the United Kingdom, or is it more in some places than others?
So we have warming across the whole of the UK, but you have to see that the warmest conditions are in the southeast. I'll give you an example. 2022, it hit 40 degrees Celsius in southern England. Now, this is unprecedented. This was in July. So July has a peak temperature over the last 10 years of about 24 degrees. So that means that heat wave was 16 degrees warmer than it should have been.
Is the rate at which we're warming accelerating? You mentioned before that it was 0.25 degrees Celsius per decade in the 80s. And now it's been 0.41 degrees Celsius. Is that rate still accelerating?
So this is really two questions in one. The first one is climate change accelerating? Yes, it is. Is that what we're expecting? Yes, because that's what the models suggest as we're pumping more and more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But the second part of the question is the last 2 years, 2023 and 2024, have been the warmest years ever recorded. Last year, we broke through and hit 1.6 degrees warmer than pre-industrial times, which was unprecedented. So the question now is scientists are looking at and saying, hey, well, are these 2 years part of a new trend where climate change is accelerating more than we expected from the models? And if so, why? And some of the ideas are we're cleaning up industry, we're cleaning up the marine industry and shipping, and that's reducing the amount of aerosols going into the atmosphere, which reflect a bit of sunlight and keep some regions cooler than they would normally be. The other big problem is we're pumping huge amounts of heat over decades into the oceans. Oceans cover 70% of the world's surface and are now acting like a giant radiator, just providing much more heat to the system.
Right, so that's one, if you like, almost kind of expected result, the heating of the oceans, and one rather unexpected result, which is the result of cleaning up on aerosols.
Yeah, by doing the right thing, we're actually causing, unfortunately, acceleration in climate change. The problem is that if we have summers and, I would say, years that we've had, like the last 2 years, and they continue in the future, this gives even more urgency to us having to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases that we're just pumping into the atmosphere.
Right, which of course will be a global question, not just a national one. Can I just ask whether we're getting fewer colder days? I mean, has White Christmas gone?
Unfortunately, yes. So what we're finding is that winters are now 1 degree warmer than they were and about 15% wetter than the last century. But when we come to snow days, and this is where we're really worried about White Christmases, we used to have, when we were kids, in later 20th century, we had 12 snow days a year. We now have less than 9 snow days. And the interesting thing is that that doesn't mean we're not going to have things like the big freeze of 2010 or the beast from the east from 2018. We're still going to have occasionally these really sharp cold snaps, particularly with the cold air coming from the Arctic and Siberia hitting the east coast of England and Scotland. We will still have those occasionally, but those are half as likely to happen now as they were in the 1960s.
Are they going to be less severe when they do happen?
Not necessarily, no, because, again, the interesting thing is because we've melted all the sea ice north of Norway and Finland, it allows that Arctic air an easier route to get to the British Isles. So if they hit, which will be a lot less likely, they would be as severe, if not worse, than usual.
Mark Maslin.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins: schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Now, rainfall and flooding. Joining me is Jess Neumann, an Associate Professor of Hydrology at the University of Reading. Jess Neumann, is extreme rainfall and flooding becoming more common in the UK?
Yes, it absolutely is. We've got the heat, as we just heard about from Mark, but we've got climate change as a driving cause of giving us a warmer atmosphere. And when that atmosphere warms up, it can hold more moisture, leading to greater rainfall. But when we have particularly these heat waves, like Mark was talking about as well, we get increased evaporation. This leads to unstable air and it fuels thunderstorms. And so we see much more intense rainfall as well, particularly during our summer months. Sure, we've all been caught in those sort of sudden downpours, particularly that come from nowhere, almost, it seems. And what we know from the Met Office is this storm rainfall is now about 20% heavier than it was in pre-industrial times. And the frequency of those super rainfall events, where we're seeing sort of 50 millimetres per day, that's increased as well. And by 2070, the expectation is that's going to be about 85% more than what we're used to.
When you talk about unstable air, what do you mean?
So when we heat up the ground, we increase the evaporation. So that's the movement of water from the surface into a gaseous state. And this rises very quickly. It's got a lot of moisture in it. And so it's quite turbulent. And this is the perfect conditions for sort of fueling those thunderstorms, those big cumulonimbus clouds, we call them, that bring with them huge amounts of heavy rain.
Jess, are there regional differences in the UK with regard to the increased amount of rainfall and the increased likelihood of storms?
So we do know that we have a generally southwesterly prevailing weather system that comes in. And so the wet is generally wetter than the east. And that's why also we see these more extreme heats sort of on the east and southeast of the country. that regional difference does lead to differences in terms of flood risk as well, but it's not as clear cut for flooding. We don't have such a clear divide, and it also depends on the types of flooding that you're experiencing. So many of us, for example, will be familiar with river floods or fluvial floods, as we call them. And if we live near a river, we might expect that we would see some flooding at certain times. But there are other types of floods. For those people who live on the coast, they're going to be much more expecting of coastal floods from high tides and strong winds. Those of us who perhaps live on chalk aquifers or sandstones or more permeable geology, we might experience groundwater flooding. And this is not a sort of east-west or a north-south divide. It can be very localized or quite extensive. So if we take the 2013-14 winter storms that left large parts of the Thames Valley underwater for a significant amount of time, that was a really, really huge flood. And it will go down in history as one of the biggest floods that we've experienced so far. But things like flash floods that come from these sudden intense downpours, particularly in the summer, they can be really quite localized. You can be hit by one of these and two streets down, it's completely dry still. So it's a very more complex picture with regards to flooding.
It's also complex for people, because people often know if they live in a floodplain. I don't think that many people know if they live in a chalk aquifer.
That's absolutely true. And we've spoken to people who live in floodplains. We see quite often that people, A, unless they're right by the river, they don't think they live in a floodplain, or they don't know. And B, we've spoken to people who say, well, why were the houses built here if it wasn't safe? And we have good faith in our planning system that houses wouldn't put us at risk. But sadly, as we've seen, that's not always the case.
Now, one of the things that you hear all the time is, how can it possibly be that we have all this rainfall happening, which we don't expect, and then we have these dry periods and we're told we're having a drought? What's going on there?
So the difficulty is, when this rain, I like to think of it as more like chaotic weather, when this rain is not consistent and typically grey and dreary, like we might think of in the UK typically, when it comes in these sudden intense bursts, it A, doesn't have time. It literally, the soil cannot absorb that water. It literally runs off, particularly if it follows a very hot or dry period, and, you know, soil can literally act like concrete. It can go solid. But when we get that intense runoff, it can run straight into our rivers and cause flooding. It's very hard to harness it. And so what we really need is more of those slightly miserable grey days with consistent and steady rain. Not that anybody probably wants to hear that.
So one of the big messages coming out of this is that we now get these incredible rainfalls at periods when we didn't used to and when we didn't expect it. Are other countries in Europe experiencing similar things to us?
So we're fairly unique in that we're not physically joined to Europe. So we're an island, and our climate is very much influenced by our proximity to the Atlantic Ocean and our prevailing southwesterly winds. So we're much more susceptible to humidity and changes in rainfall patterns than perhaps continental Europe is. But what we are seeing across Europe, and we've heard Mark talk about it, we're seeing more floods, we're seeing droughts, heat waves, wildfires, and these are also increasing in frequency and magnitude, just like they are here. We only have to look back, for example, to summer of 2021, where we had those exceptionally devastating floods across parts of Western Europe. We can think back to last year with Valencia and the huge floods that unfortunately took a lot of lives there as well. So it is changing, and it's not just the UK. When we take Europe as a continent, as a landmass in itself, it is warming at more than twice the global average. So at the moment, we're looking at about 0.5 of a degree centigrade. So that's a huge amount of warming.
Jess, thank you very much. And you're still with me, and so's Mark Maslin. But now I want to bring in Richard Dawson, who's Professor of Engineering at Newcastle University, as we move on to the section we call Problems and Solutions. Richard, you've been listening to this, and we'll come to homes and individuals later. But is our infrastructure currently experiencing problems with the way in which the weather and climate have changed?
Yes, is the short answer. And we've just been hearing from Mark and Jess about how the frequency and intensity of extreme weather like heat waves and flooding is increasing. And inevitably, that translates into more damage and more disruption to our infrastructure. There are some big reasons for that. And one of those is that a lot of our infrastructure is actually in areas at risk of flooding. For example, just over a third of our roads, railways, water pumping stations and treatment plants are all in areas at risk of flooding. We've also seen energy and communications infrastructure be disrupted by flooding and heat waves too. And these are all important because each of these provides vital services that we increasingly rely on day by day as part of our modern economy.
Now, flooding, I understand, quite obviously stuff goes underwater. And I think we remember that period when also some electricity stations went underwater and the problems those caused. What about heat? What infrastructural problems does heat itself cause?
Well, there's a couple of problems, but one, for example, on railway networks, they're made of metal that absorbs the heat as it warms up, often much higher rate than the outdoor air temperature. That wants to expand and therefore at risk of buckling. And the last thing you want when you're on a kind of straight railway line is to hit a wobble. And in this country, when the air temperature exceeds around about 30 degrees centigrade, the rails can be at risk of buckling. And it's around that sort of temperature that Network Rail will start to look at slowing down the speed at which trains could travel on those lines for safety reasons. And across the kind of the whole country, that can, of course, cost millions in terms of lost economic activity and, of course, ensuring the repairing and maintenance of that track.
And do we have problems with roads in extreme heat?
It has been less obvious to date, but yes, when it gets really hot, our tarmac can soften, start to melt as well. And of course, that increases the risks of damage, potholes, and so on as well. We also see similar sort of challenges in terms of our energy infrastructure as our overhead lines warm up. And sometimes those can be electrified rail lines as well as our major power lines warm up. They can sag and are actually less efficient at transmitting electricity.
Okay, so that's just now. Going forward and with anticipated levels of warming, what kind of infrastructural problems might we need to anticipate?
Further ahead, we're seeing that the way we use our infrastructure is starting to change. We know that when it gets hotter, we might want to flip on the switch and get a fan going or increasingly air conditioning. We might need to drink more water for ourselves or more for our crops to ensure they can grow. Some other changes are perhaps less visible. It's not necessarily immediately obvious how crucial water supply is to support our digital economy. All of those data centers, all of those AI number crunching hubs, they require water, for example, to stop them overheating. And we're also changing our infrastructure. How and what we need as part of a modern economy is part of that. And increasingly, we are in a digital world reliant on communication systems, not just to talk to each other, but to support things like home healthcare, to support community services like banking and so on. We're also in an increasingly electrified world, not just to keep lights on in our house, but it is now our dominant energy source and growing into areas like transport and other systems as well. So the impacts of disruption are far more pervasive and substantial than they might have been 20 or so years ago.
I think that raises a whole series of issues, Mark Maslin. But the first one I want to look at is when it comes to citizens ourselves, what we have to do or our situation, how well equipped are our homes and lifestyles specifically to deal with greater heat?
So at the moment in the UK, homes are very poorly prepared. So we've been trying to improve our housing stock because we have some of the worst housing stock of Europe.
Because it's the oldest.
It is the oldest, but it's also because we haven't invested. We don't have renter agreements. We don't have guaranteed levels of sort of standards for renting it. And so therefore, we have had a housing stock that's slowly deteriorated. So we've been trying to build new houses with high standards, but they are focused on energy efficiency. So that means making them more airtight, making sure that they're greater insulated, but they haven't taken into consideration the hotter summers. So therefore, if you go to any other really hot country. They have air conditioning as standard. And many of us actually go into work just because we have air conditioning at work, whereas we don't have at home, which is ridiculous. You know, sort of, again, so we have to change our mindset about how we live in the UK, that our homes do have to be warm, because guess what? The UK is actually quite a cold country, and for most of the time, the temperatures are below 20 degrees, so you need some central heating. But we're getting more and more frequent hot weather during the summer where we need to cool down, because of course it's a risk to people's lives.
There's an analogy here, isn't there? I mean, I was always asked by Americans, for instance, why it is we couldn't cope with snow on the road when it came. And the answer, obvious answer, was because we just didn't have enough of it to want to have snow tyres. So the same answer has been true of air conditioning. We just haven't had enough of the hot weather to need the air conditioning. And what you're saying is that's changed.
Oh, absolutely. So if we go back to the last century, 1976 is the hot summer that everybody talks about. But it was a one-off. And for the next couple of decades, nothing like that ever happened. We have now had that almost every summer for the last 10 years. So these hot conditions are here to stay. Now, they may only last 2 or 3 days, or maybe a week at most, each time they come. But they affect people's health in a really, really severe way.
Can I just ask you what may be an impossible question to answer? Don't people actually just adapt their behaviour when they find it's getting hotter? They take more water with them. They know what to do. They find out what to do to try and keep cool.
Oh, absolutely. And also the health systems. Really interesting case study was the 2003 heatwave in Europe. Huge number of people lost their lives in Paris. The French were distraught about this. They changed all of their health systems, and therefore they realized that they didn't know where the vulnerable people were. So they started a wonderful way of actually cataloguing where all the elderly people were in Paris. So when the next heat wave came along, which was in 2007, they actually knew where they were, so they could go and check on them. They could actually make sure they were fine. So health systems and people do adapt, but you can't adapt, particularly if your flat isn't able to cool down at night. And that, it's the nighttime temperatures which are the killers.
Jess, can I ask you the same question I asked Mark, but with regard to flooding? How well equipped are the citizenry and our homes to deal with flooding?
So for a lot of us, we're not particularly well prepared to deal with flooding. And I think the first thing that I would always say to people, if you're going to do anything, please just check if you are at flood risk. And you can do this online via the government portal. At the moment, just over 6 million homes are at risk of flooding of some description. And only about 1.6 million of those are signed up to receive these free flood alerts and warnings. So it's very hard to prep if you don't even know that you're at risk to start with. But there are things you can do. We call it property flood resilience. And we can install things like non-return valves on our pipes. It's one thing to be flooded. You really don't want your wastewater coming back up into your property as well. You can have self-closing air bricks. We'd recommend that if you are making changes, you're doing a renovation, that think about perhaps the materials you use in your property. So carpets, not great. They absorb a lot of water. Tiling, much easier to get water out and to clean after, you know, should the worst happen if you have been flooded. There's things like electricity and water, they don't go very well together. So being able to raise your electrical sockets, being able to think about how you move your valuable appliances to a higher level with ease, should you have to make sort of decisions and actions quickly in the event of flooding. But most importantly, if you are at risk or if you have been flooded, do think about investing in some flood barriers, because they're your sort of biggest defense at your back door for stopping that water coming into your property. And that's really key.
Richard Dawson, what do you think?
As we heard from Jess, there's millions of homes and properties and businesses at risk of flooding across the UK. And about a decade ago, the government, working with the insurance industry, established Flood Re, which is effectively a reinsurance company, but it's not for profit and it's publicly accountable. And that has really enabled much wider access to flooding insurance in areas at risk of flooding. However, there are some caveats with that, that whilst most homes in high flood risk areas are eligible to access and benefit from that, properties constructed from 2009 onwards flats in large leasehold blocks and businesses are not covered by this scheme. And although we don't have exact numbers, it's estimated that there are over about 100,000 houses that were built in areas at high risk since 2009. Some of those, of course, will have flood defences, but not all of them will. And whilst we have seen that around 90 to 95% of people living in areas of flood risk are able to get multiple insurance quotes, we don't know how much those quotes are for, so how much that their insurance is going to cost them, or how many are unable to still get flood insurance. So there's still some way to go to ensure that sort of universal coverage. Now, one good thing I think that's emerged in the last few years, and we heard Jess talking about some of those property level actions that people can take to protect their own houses. Well, the insurance industry have mostly signed up to this Build Back Better scheme. And what that does is give grants to those who've been flooded to embed those resilience measures after a flood. And hopefully that means if there is a future flood, then the impacts of that will be less severe in those properties.
Jess, I was very struck earlier when you were talking about the degree of unpredictability and turbulence in the field that you were looking at. And that does bring up the question of early warnings of major events. Do we have the early warning systems in place? And insofar as we might need to improve them, how do we do that?
So we do have them in place. And I think many of us on our weather app will see those little exclamation marks, the yellow, the amber weather warnings. That's informing us, it's warning us of impending, possibly severe weather. And as I've said, I would always implore anybody to look to see if they need to sign up to the free flood warnings and alerts that come from the Environment Agency. I get mine through my Alexa, for example. But there is a lot of uncertainty. And we only have to think about just a few weeks ago with those horrific and devastating Texas floods when the early warning chain breaks down. Because before you get that little alert on your phone that says, you know, impending possible severe weather or flood risk, a lot of stuff has already happened. A lot of decisions have been taken and a lot of actions put in place. So we rely, for example, on some accurate weather forecasts. So that gives us an indication of how extreme the rainfall is going to be. That then has to be put into a flood model, which tells us how the water will behave when it gets to the ground. And that's not going to be the same every time. If it's rained recently, that water is going to behave differently to if it's been really dry, for example. How full are our rivers, for example? And at that point, a decision will be made about whether a threshold looks like it's going to be reached, where, for example, a flood warning would be given. But that decision making has to be done before you even see the warning come through on your phone. Now, the other part of the chain is once you receive that warning, who takes action on it? Some people do, some people don't. And if there's a stall in that early warning chain at any point, or if it breaks down completely, i.e. communication doesn't get through, and that's what we saw in the Germany floods of 2021, that final bit of information was not shared with most of the public. And so they weren't able to take action. So there's a lot still to be done. We've got technological advances, brilliant supercomputers that are working on the sort of forecasting and the modeling side of things. But that human interaction with how we encourage people to take action, how we get them to engage, and what decisions they make is a really, really key part of where we need to go in the future to make sure that we keep people safe as well as possible.
Jess Newman there with Mark Masden and Richard Dawson. And just before we go, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast on the BBC Sounds app and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about government debt, the one about how close the UK is getting to the EU, and the one about Europe's defence dilemma. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Sally Abrahams and Kirsteen Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineer was Neil Churchill. And the editor was Richard Varden. And another edition of this podcast will be along again very soon.
I'm Rory Stewart, and I want to talk about heroes. When I was a child, I imagined a heroic future for myself in which I would achieve great things and die sacrificing my life for a noble cause before I was 30. But my experiences in the Middle East and in politics showed me that there was something deeply wrong with my idea of heroism. From BBC Radio 4, my podcast, The Long History of Heroism, explores ideas of what it meant to be a hero through time. How have these ideas changed? Who are the heroes we need today? Listen to Rory Stewart, The Long History of Heroism, first on BBC Sounds.